Nee, warte mal, das geht aber.
Yes.
Can you hear me?
Hello?
Hear me.
Hello?
Can.
Yes. Can you listen? Can you hear me?
You should bring it a little closer.
Now. Can you hear me now? Hello? Hello, hello? I'm talking. No?
Can you?
Hello?
Perfect. This is good, but not too much.
A, B, C. Okay, A, B, C. A, B, C, E, F, G, H, I, J.
I have 45 minutes. Okay, good. But you'll show me.
I'll show you 10 and I'll show you 5.
Okay, good.
Hello. I would like to welcome everyone to the first Potsdam workshop on integrability, engage, and string theory. It is kind of a sociological experiment because we've actually managed to bring together three groups of physicists which would ordinarily not necessarily go to the same conference: gauge theorists, specialists in condensed matter theory, integrability, and string theorists. And accordingly, we would call it a success if you all mingle a lot and discuss a lot. And in order to enable that, we have a brainstorming room upstairs. You'll see directions with a blackboard. And there's also these white walls out there with where you can you're allowed to write on with the provided pens. So let's see let's try to communicate and share each other's knowledge. There will be further announcements on details of the organization along the way. For the moment, I believe we should just start. All the talks here in the main part of the conference are 45 minutes, except for the Thursday afternoon. Well, you get further instructions, Marcel Grossmann parallel session. So the ordinary talks here are 45 minutes with a 5-minute overlap time between the next talk. So I'd like to first welcome Kostia Zarembo, who together with Joe Minahan in a certain sense created this whole field. There were interesting observations by other people before, in particular by Lev Lipatov, who will speak later today. But it's fair to say that their paper started up this current activity. So please, Kostia, start.
Thank you, Matthias. I'll report on the work we have done with Thomas Klose and some other work in progress. It is about beta ansatz and some simple sigma models in two dimensions. So it is by now more or less clear that the appropriate framework to describe a CFT correspondence is integrability and beta ansatz. And this is not something very familiar to string theorists. So Thomas and I just try to learn the appropriate tricks that has been used in applying beta ansatz to sigma models. So, I think I'm going to skip the introduction mostly, but let me just say that EDCFT correspondence is a beautiful prediction of string theory, and it's perhaps a testable prediction. It's not very easy to test it because it's a strong weak coupling duality. So it states that n equal 4 supersymmetric Engels theory in 4 dimensions is exactly equivalent to string theory on the ADS 5 crosses 5 background. And the inverse number of colors in gauge theory, which is the parameter of the topological expansion, is more or less identified with this string coupling. So if we send n to infinity, then we expect strings to become free, but still quantum. And the parameter that that governs, that is the h bar of string theory, is inversely proportional to the tooth coupling of Young-Mills theory. So when Young-Mills theory is weakly coupled, string theory is very quantum and hard to understand, and vice versa. But still, we expect that the spectra of two theories are equivalent, so the spectrum of local operators in Young-Mills is equivalent to a string spectrum of string theory. So if we are somehow able to calculate the string spectrum, we immediately know the spectrum of four-dimensional Young-Mills theory. Unfortunately, there are some technical complications, or complications that look technical, in solving this problem, because the string theory is basically a free string theory is reduces to a two-dimensional sigma model with a certain background. In ADS 5 crosses 5, this background contains the Ramon-Ramon flux, which means that the sigma model is of Green-Schwarz type. So our usual method to go to conformal gauge and then use some kind of representation theory for Virasoro algebra or some other infinite dimensional algebra seemingly fails because the conformal gauge here is problematic for very well-known reasons. Lightcon gauge is okay, but the action is very complicated. And still it is integrable. So it was shown by Benny Palczynski and Raiban back in 2003 that this model is completely integrable. And this gives us hope to solve it by Betanzas, because Betanzas is the standard tool to solve integrable models in two dimensions. Now, well, Betanzas is a very interesting approach, which incorporates the relationship between the spectrum and the S-matrix. And a lot of effort in the field represented in this conference is related to establishing this relationship between the S-matrix and the spectrum. And since many people are working on this, I think it is important to understand the limitations of this approach and the tricks that are used to avoid these limitations. So, in the first place, it's not immediately clear how the spectrum, and we want the spectrum of closed string, is related to the S-matrix, because closed string means that our two-dimensional space is space-time is a cylinder, so space is a circle of finite circumference, and the S-matrix is defined on the plane, so we need asymptotic states, so the spatial variable should run from minus infinity to plus infinity. Nevertheless, the S-matrix and the spectrum are closely related. And let me start with a very simple, if not trivial, example of one-dimensional particle moving in a scattering of a potential bump, or potential, well, doesn't really matter, which is short-ranged. And then suppose that we put the same particle in a box. So periodize the potential in some way and want to find the energy, periodic energy levels of this periodic problem. So then there is a magic formula for the energy levels that relates the spacing of the levels with the scattering phase shift on the infinite line. So this is, any decent textbook on quantum mechanics has this formula. And it's of course approximate, so there are corrections related to the finiteness of the range of the potential. So if the range of the potential, the range of interaction is small, and the length is sufficiently large, then corrections are small, and this is a good approximation. In fact, there is only one case when it is exact, and this is the case of the delta functional potential. Actually, I've recently done the calculation and checked that it really works. I'm sure all of you know quantum mechanics, but still let me repeat this textbook derivation of this formula. So we start with the wave function on the infinite line, and then so at x going to minus infinity, the wave function is plus infinity also, the wave function just oscillates, but if we go through the potential, it the phase undergoes a shift by a finite amount, which is the scattering shift. So here and here we can approximate the wave function by a cosine, but with different arguments. Now if we go to the periodic problem, we want to periodize this wave function, and then for it to be continuous, we need to impose the integrality condition on the phase at this point, so that it coincides with the phase at this point. And this means that this this combination should be an integer multiple of 2 pi. And this is the same formula as on the previous slide, because we just consider a non-relativistic particle. So from this derivation, it's clear why it is approximate, because of course this oscillating behavior requires the potential to be sufficiently small. Already the finite range where we cut this line into pieces and then make the wave function periodic. Okay, so let's write down this relation yet in another form, where this integer disappears. So it is just tells us that the oscillating part of the wave function should be compensated by the scattering shift. So let me repeat that this is correct up to certain corrections, typically exponential. Well, that depends on the particular form of the potential, but if the potential decays exponentially, then the corrections are also exponential. Also, the same formula works for bound states. So if the potential had bound states on the infinite line, then in the S matrix they appear as poles, and to see how they are shifted if we impose boundary conditions, we can use the same equation, but we need to analytically continue this matrix to complex momentum. So now it seems that it's very easy to generalize this formula. It should be a general fact. So why then textbooks on quantum mechanics do not give any generalizations to higher dimensions or to multi-particle systems? Well, I will explain the reasons shortly, but it seems that at least for multi-particle case, we can easily generalize it, so that we can put several particles on the interval, they scatter on each other, and then again the oscillating part of the wave function should be compensated by the scattering product of S matrices, so that the wave function can be made periodic, and then we get a set of equations on particle momenta, which are called beta equations, and they are just quantization conditions for momentum on this interval. So why this looks like a very, very general fact? Why is it not present in quantum mechanics textbooks and only advanced monographies on integrable systems? Well, the reason is that the assumptions that we made here are actually more strong than in the one particle case. So of course we assume that the range of interactions is sufficiently small, but also we assume that the scattering doesn't change the momentum of the particle. So if the particle goes through without any disturbances to its momentum, and also that there are no inelastic processes, the number of particles is conserved. And these are very strong assumptions, and they are only satisfied in two dimensions, or can be, more or less can be satisfied only in two dimensions, which is just a simple kinematics. So to explain it, let me switch to a more field theoretical language. So let's consider a 2x2 scattering in two dimensions. So we have two particles going into other particles with some initial momentum to some final momentum, relativistic or non-relativistic, to this end it doesn't matter. So then from energy and momentum conservation imposes two equations on the kinematical variables. Let us consider these two equations as conditions on the final states, on the momentum K1 and K2, and assuming non-relativistic dispersion relations, let's try to solve these two equations. The easiest way to do it is just do it graphically. So the energy conservation is a circle, so E equals P squared, so it's just a circle. And momentum conservation is a line. And the circle and the line, in general, intersect at two points. Now, to find these intersection points, we need not do any calculations. These are just, so one intersection is when momentum do not change at all, and the other intersection when, well, they are just interchanged. So it's a transition and reflection processes. So there are only two allowed values of final momentum if you fix initial momentum. So there is no phase space into two going to two scattering in two dimensions. And this is the reason why for the, well, two particle case is basically the first example that I showed you, then it works universally. But if you go to multi-particle scattering, again, energy and momentum conservations are two equations for, well, whatever amount of initial variables we have. So in general, we have only two equations for n unknowns, and so there will be n minus two-dimensional phase space. So the final momenta will in general be different. The S matrix will be an operator. And basically, there is no this simple equation for the energy level, so the infinite system will not work. Unless there are extra conservation laws. And here the integrability comes into play. So if you have some number of quantities that are conserved and which are some functions of momenta which are functionally independent, then in each such process we have infinite equations, infinite number of equations to satisfy. And the only way to satisfy these equations is to say that final momenta are absolutely the same as the initial momenta. So in integral systems, end-to-end scattering also do not have a phase space just because there are infinitely many conservation laws. For the same reason, all particle production processes are kinematically forbidden. There is no way to satisfy the conservation conditions for this infinite number of additional conserved charges. So, in general, the final state will be different from the initial state by permutation of momentum. Now, or in more general case, by permutation of quantum numbers as well, some extra quantum numbers like flavor or something like that. So, since any permutation can be written as a product of transposition, the multi-body S matrix can also be factorized into 2x2 scattering matrices. So, there is this famous factorization formula, and the condition that this factorization doesn't depend on in which order we have done it leads to a nonlinear equation for this basic 2x2 scattering matrix known as the Young-Baxter equation. So it just tells us that the order in which these transpositions are taken is not important. It more or less follows. It's okay, so the conclusion is that if you have an integrable system, then beta ansatz is at worst will be approximate. So we are guaranteed that the spectrum on the finite line is described to some approximation by beta equations. If the interactions in addition are local, then the beta ansatz will be exact, like in this delta function example in the one-body problem in quantum mechanics. And it looks like we are in good shape here, because in any decent quantum field theory is local, so it's in this first quantized language it will be that all interactions will be delta functions. So it seems that Bärensatz is a very generic approach to an integrable system, but you'll see that in relativistic quantum field theories there is a certain complication arising, but otherwise we just need to solve first one body problem to find dispersion relation, then two body problem to find the phase shifts, and then plug them at the beta equation and we get the full spectrum. Again, in relativistic field theories we also need to find a true ground state in general for the reasons to be explained. So let me just give two examples. I hope they will exemplify the points that I'm trying to make. So first example is the standard example of nonlinear Schrödinger model. It's a non-relativistic field theory of one complex scalar field. So it has just first order time derivatives. So it's just a non-relativistic theory. It is integrable, and as a first quantized system, it describes bosons that interact via delta functional potential, repulsive or attractive, depending on the coupling, on the sign of the coupling constant. It's clear, by the way, that the attractive case is unstable. Anyway, if it's repulsive, then we can just try to find the S matrix, and then beta answers will produce the complete multipart spectrum. So, in fact, there is a very nice way to calculate the S matrix in this model. It's just a simple diagrammatic calculation. So we start with the three-level diagram. This can be easily evaluated. Physically, it corresponds to Born approximation for the delta functional potential for two particles. Now, if you add a one-loop diagram, there is only S-channel diagram in this model. This is important. It's really important that there are no T-channel and U-channel exchanges. And the reason for that is that there are no antiparticles here. It is a non-relativistic field theory. And this S-channel diagram is nothing but the first iteration of Lippmann-Schwinger equation for the first quantized quantum mechanical problem. It can also be easily calculated, and then we can go on, resum this series of bubble diagrams, and then we get this S matrix that was first obtained by Young in 1967. Plugging it in beta equations indeed produced the exact spectrum that can be derived by various other means like coordinate beta ansatz or algebraic beta ansatz. Anyway, these equations describe completely the physics of the model, so one can study various things with them. But I'll just stop here and go on to another example. Actually, this approach, it works for any integrable non-relativistic field theory. In particular, it works for an integrable sigma model. So the non-linearity here is not really important. You can still sum the same bubble diagrams and get the exact S matrix. So in one of these examples that popped up in ADA CFT context is the Landau-Lifshitz sigma model, which is low energy effective field theory of one-dimensional ferromagnet. In the ADA CFT context, it on the one hand describes anomalous dimensions of certain operators with a lot of constituent fields, where these fields are associated with spins on the lattice. On the other hand, it was shown to describe certain classical string states in ADS5 process 5. So if one takes strings that move in some subspace of ADS5 process 5 and they move sufficiently fast, so one can take separate fast and slow variables, and this is the effective energy for the slow variables. Now let's quantize this model, although it's, as a quantum theory, it does, has nothing to do with ADS-CFT. Repeating the same calculation with the chain of bubbles, we get this S matrix, and then we can plug them in the beta ansatz, and this describes the full spectrum of the model. So it's the exact answer, period. Now, if you go to the relativistic cases, and here is an example, I take the model was that was proposed by Alder, Tyunov, and Frolov, then there are some complications arise. So this model is integrable. In fact, it's also a subsector of ADS string theory. Instead of considering string that moves in the three sphere, we consider string that moves in superspace and throw away all bosonic degrees of freedom or gauge fix them. And then one gets, after some calculations, one gets this action, and it inherits the integrability of the original sigma model. So we can just regard it as an example of a two-dimensional integrable field theory and try to understand what is its spectrum. Perturbatively, it's just one Dirac fermion in two dimensions. So it describes particle and an antiparticle with mass m. Now if we calculate the S matrix, we can do it, probably one can start with perturbation theory, so at three level we get the same as we would get from Born approximation for the Dirac equation, and the answer is most easily written in terms of the rapidity. But then at one loop we stumble over a problem. So in addition to the S-channel diagram, which is more or less the first iteration of Lippmann-Schmidinger equation, we also get the U-channel exchange and the T-channel exchanges. And in the first quantized language, they have very different interpretation. They're interpreted as correction to the potential itself, not as iteration of the original potential. Because of the vacuum polarization, the potential is modified by quantum correction. So this can be sort of an exchange by a pair of particles, virtual particles, and it leads to a correction to the potential, which is still short range if the mass of the particle is sufficiently large, but it is of finite range. So even if we were able to resum all of the diagrams and compute this matrix, the better answers for this S-matrix would be an approximation, or still it's useful, one can do, for instance, thermodynamics with it, but it will not describe the spectrum on the finite interval exactly. Now there are tricks to overcome this problem. And these are well-known tricks, but let me spend some time explaining them, because the method is rather unusual, doesn't look very natural. So the reason why this vacuum polarization bubble is non-zero is because there are antiparticles. So the propagator has two poles, one corresponds to particle, another to antiparticle. And then, just calculating the diagram, we can see that the non-zero answer comes from the residues of this from this poles. So let's do the following thing. Let's move the antiparticle pole downstairs to the from the integration axis, and then the bubble will disappear because the residue the contour of integration will go will not encircle any poles. So we just changed the pole prescription for the propagator. And what it means physically is that we impose a chemical potential on the system, negative chemical potential on the system. So if chemical potential is negative and finite, then it crosses the, I mean, normally it would cross the real axis at zero, but if it's negative, it crosses it somewhere at some negative value minus mu. If you then send mu to minus infinity, then all the poles will lie below the real axis, and we will have no antiparticles. So this means that we leave the Fermi C empty. So this is this. As far as I know, this was first applied to string model by Berezin and Sushko, and then Berkhoff and Thaker and Karapin used to use this trick to solve the model by Petanzas. The trick is to quantize the model in this vacuum, which is the, well, it's not the vacuum, it's just some state in the Hilbert space, which is very far from the ground state, but nevertheless, if we manage to write down the exact equations for the spectrum on this reference state, we can then refill the negative energy antiparticles levels to get the true vacuum. So, to summarize, the empty Dirac C has two effects. First, it makes the potential remains local because there are no vacuum polarization. There is no antiparticles. Since the Dirac C is empty, if we insert a particle in the vacuum, it has nothing to polarize. Then the S matrix is very simple. So many diagrams become zero in this vacuum because of this pole prescription. So the two-body S matrix is again a chain of bubbles. In this particular model, it can be, well, resummed. And as a matter of fact, it coincides with the S matrix of Breathers and Sein-Gordon. So probably this model is equivalent to Sein-Gordon theory. You know, two dimensions, manifold theories are equivalent among each other. Anyway, one can write down the beta equations. So for rapidities of the particles, and the energy is the sum of these rapidities. But now there are many solutions of this equation with negative energy. So if we insert a particle with imaginary rapidity, whose imaginary part is pi, then we will basically lower the energy. So we have to fill all negative energy levels in the rapidity plane. This is just this line. And then we can reconstruct the true vacuum from, but now exactly in the Petanzas approach. And of course, all these niceties of quantum field theory strike back, so everything starts to diverge. So this chain of bubbles contains no divergences, so this matrix is absolutely finite. But here, when we try to fill out this vacuum, then we have to introduce a cutoff because equations produce infinities. And well, this leads to mass renormalization with some critical index and so on and so forth. So here is the equation, and in principle from this equation one can extract everything: the mass renormalization, the physical spectrum, and the physical S matrix. I will not show you the calculations. We actually didn't complete them completely. But anyway, the physics of this model is such that it's mostly non-renormalizable. So it's, for instance, it's non-renormalizable in the weak coupling regime, where the mass has complex anomalous dimension. In the attractive regime, it's unstable, the energy is unbounded below. So the only regime where it is sensible as field theory is a strong repulsive regime, And there it consists, the spectrum consists of just fermion and an antifermion with non-trivial scattering, which in principle can be calculated. How much time do I have? 12 minutes, okay. So in these 12 minutes I'll try to explain what's, I mean, some potential implications for ADS CFT. Well, actually in ADS CFT there has been a lot of work along these directions. This matrix is virtually known, at least the tensor structure of it is known, so it's known to some unimportant factors. This means that beta equations are nearly known. It has been understood what are the elementary, what is actually being scattered. So what are the elementary building blocks of these beta ansatz? And it turns out that those are solitons on the world sheet, which is called, for some reasons, giant magnets. Since they are giant, they have finite size, which means that probably the beta spectrum has finite size corrections. Oh, and there is a lot of evidence from the superannual side where this beta ansatz works beautifully for the spectrum of operators. Anyway, so since we know that the finite size corrections are there, it would be, or we expect them to be there, it would be interesting to quantify this and see what is the accuracy. So in general, I don't know how to answer this question, but one can do some experimental math. So take some particular state, say for instance semi-classical state, which is described by very long rotating string in ADS5 process 5, calculate quantum corrections to it, and then analyze it using beta ansatz and compare. So one particular solution that for which this program can be accomplished is a string that rotates in ADS3 cross S1, so spaced with this metric. It's a subspace of ADS5 cross S5. So T ADS5 contains time variable, and then it contains a radial variable and several angles, so we keep just one angle, and we take one angle from the sphere, which is just a coordinate on the equator of the 5 sphere. So the solution was found by Aretyunov, Rusa and Seitlin, and it is a very simple solution. It's in these variables it's just linear. So the string winds around S5 m times and rotates with some angular frequency, and winds k times around ADS, around this equatorial angle in ADS, and also rotates with the same frequency, and it has also some winding number. So it can be pictured as this winding of the torus, which rotates around its axis. So time evolution is very simple. And from that one can calculate the energy as a function of spin. So since it rotates, it has an angular momentum on S5 and the spin in ADS. And those should be identified with the spin of the dual operator in Jahn-Mills and R charge of the operator, and energy is the scaling dimension. Now this is to the leading order in 1 over square root of lambda, so I remind you that lambda is here is the Hooft coupling of superannuals, and 1 over square root of lambda is the h bar of string theory. So the energy has expansion in 1 over square root of lambda at strong coupling. The leading order is this classical energy. Then there is one loop correction, two loop corrections, and so on. And one loop correction is just the sum of the fluctuation frequencies taken with signs. Now, in this particular case, it was calculated by Park, Tirzi, and Seitlin. You see, there is a very nice formula for that. And that can be compared to the results of beta ansatz. So in beta ansatz, basically, we also need to take the semi-classical expansion. So we start with some with this classical part, which is the integral equation. So beta ansatz, the classical approximation to beta ansatz is an integral equation. And then corrections are here on the right hand side. There are basically two types of this correction. One is from certain anomaly contribution, and the other is from quantum correction to the scattering phase. So the scattering phase itself is a series in this string coupling. Amazingly, this correction was partially calculated, partially guessed. You see, this is the expression for it, and it works. So indeed, if one takes the string to be very long, and remarkably, the long string limit is the same as perturbative limit in Gamma-Yells. So because the length of the string is the R charge divided by the square root of the coupling, so if this is very large, this means that lambda, divided by this factor, is very small. So this is sort of perturbative regime in the super-Riemannians. And this is the regime that was studied most in the beginning, because it allowed to compare to gauge theory. So people studied this regime in quite detail. And it was shown that string and beta calculations agree to all orders in the string, in this lambda over j squared. But there are exponential corrections, which seems to disagree. Okay. These equations are complicated. To compare, one has to take some limits. So this is one possible limit. The other limit, which is even simpler, is decompactification limit, when we take not only this, the length to infinity, but also the winding to infinity. And this limit was considered by Minahan, Tirza, and Zeitlin in some other cases. They conjectured that in this limit, the quantum correction should disappear. And we can check that it indeed the case, both from string side and from the beta side. So here it works. A little bit more complicated limit is when we take the winding to infinity, but keep the length finite. Then the answer, this limit is tractable. It's not very simple, but tractable. So one gets the following expressions from the string and beta sides, and it seems that they disagree by a finite amount. So the interpretation of this is that there are exponential corrections that in the lengths that are not captured by beta ansatz. Okay. This is everything, more or less everything what I wanted to say. So, in conclusion, let me repeat that we strongly suspect that the spectrum of ADS CFT corresponders is encoded in this sort of equation. The remaining questions, of course, are what is S here? And then the second question is what is e to the I pi L? And finally, why are they equal? Thank you.
Thank you very much, Kostya. Now we come to the questions. Don't be shy.
Oh, I read in Greensworth Witten that one has to introduce ghosts for ghosts and for ghosts and so on. So there, that the honest fixing this gauge produces too many. I mean, there, the constraints are too complicated. Yeah, it's Kappa symmetry and diffeomorphism invariance produces too complicated constraints, even in flat space up. And then there are no kinetic term for fermions, so one has to choose the background. And also, the equations of motion are such that currents are not holomorphic. The symmetric currents are not holomorphic. So we don't expect to get very nice operator algebra.
Maybe I have a question for you. So you showed us that in this fermionic reduction, there's a very nice and fast way to get the S matrix. Did you try it for the full theory?
We are trying. We are in the process.
Are there any further questions?
Yes. But remember that this S matrix was not a physical S matrix. Yeah. One had to carefully choose this reference state, which is not a physical state, but which is nice in some sense.
Well, it would be great to have find a good pseudo vacuum for the full string.
Right, that's a complicated problem.
For the SU11, 1/1 sector, could you remind me what prevents you from comparing it with the results of Weiser-Strohdacher for their equations?
Well, as it should, it perfectly agrees classically.
But classically,
because classically it's
there's no classics in this sector. Yes.
Well, in some sense, three level. Okay, let's call three level classical. So the three level they agree, as they should. Beyond three level they disagree, which I also expect because they are written. The Weiser-Strohdacher S matrix is the physical S matrix written for physical excitations. As far as I understand it.
So you have to fill the vacuum, etc. Why is this program difficult?
Because this is just a subsector, so treating it quantum mechanically doesn't give any information about the full theory. You cannot truncate the full theory quantum mechanically.
Thank you.
Okay, then. One more question.
Is it possible that the vacuum in this sector still be a good vacuum for both of the other sector?
Perhaps, but one has to specify vacuum for other modes as well.
They couldn't be the usual vacuum for the other modes and the vacuum, the empty vacuum for these modes?
Probably not, because one has to suppress antiparticles, all antiparticles.
But if you have
usually.
If you have this very large density of fermions, you might think it would give mass.
The reason is not just giving mass, but it's more that we don't want vacuum to be polarized by anything. So we don't want any virtual particle to be there.
Okay, very well. We will thank Kostian one second time, but I just want to make an announcement. So now there is a coffee break of about half an hour, then we continue with Zwiebeln. And also, if you haven't registered yet and paid your fee, please do so, preferably in the lunch break. There's a long lunch break. And now you should just enjoy the coffee, but we should also thank Kostian one more time.
Fast.